Hey, y'all. As you likely know, the one and only sponsor of the Hashtag Am Writing podcast is Author Accelerator, the book coaching program that helps writers all the way through their projects to the very end. Usually, Author Accelerator offers only long-term coaching, and they're great at it. But they've just launched something new, Inside Outline Coaching, a four-week-long program for novelists and memoir writers that can help you find just the right amount of structure so that you can plot or pants your way to an actual draft. I love the Inside Outline, and I think you will too. I come back to mine again and again, whether I'm writing or revising. Working through it with someone else helps keep you honest and helps you deliver a story structure that works. Find out more at authoraccelerator.com/insideoutline.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause and...
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three. Okay.
I'm KJ Delantonio.
And I'm Jess Leahy.
And this is Hashtag Am Writing.
With Jess and KJ.
Hashtag Am Writing is the podcast about writing all the things, be they short, long, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, YA, proposals, pitches. Long and the short of it is, hey, I get to use the words long and short like 16 times in this intro. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting the work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and an upcoming book about preventing substance abuse in kids. And I write for The Washington Post and The New York Times and various other outlets.
I am KJ Delantonio, author of a novel coming out next year, as well as also a parent-y type book, How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor of The New York Times Motherload blog. But I saw someone in one of our reviews accusing us of having a nonfiction focus on parenting writing, to which I was
all,
what?
Yeah, I saw that too.
Like, in
not anymore.
What? Well, no, I mean, that has certainly been our professional writing, but
right.
I guess our guests probably skew that way, but not today.
Not today.
All
not
right.
Today. Today, I'm so excited. Can I introduce?
Yes.
Because I'm super excited. Today, our guest is Jocelyn Jackson. She is a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of 9 novels, including one that I am, spoiler, not finished with, so be careful, called Never Have I Ever. It is so good. But one of the big reasons we wanted to have Jocelyn on today is that she does something that almost no one really does, which is she narrates her own fiction, audio. And, we know a lot of people, including ourselves, who narrated our own nonfiction, but fiction is a whole other game. Not only does she narrate her own fiction, she's really, really good at it. She's won a bunch of awards. She was nominated for an Audi Award. She's on Audiophile Magazine's Best of the Year list. She was an Audible All-Star for the highest listener ranks and reviews. I mean, that's, huge. And then I also have to add, because near and dear to my heart, she also works with an organization called Reforming Arts, and she has taught writing and literature inside Georgia's maximum security facility for women. So we have that in common as well. Welcome so much to the show, Jocelyn. We're so excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
We, we love talking to authors, but one of the topics that has come up a lot for us is narrating audiobooks, not only because Serena Bowen, one of our frequent guests and sort of another host, she has a podcast about audiobooks specifically. I'm a huge audiobook fan, and we've been talking a lot lately about, people who choose to narrate their own fiction, because it's really hard. So we would love to talk to you about that today, but we'd love to start with sort of just how you got started with writing. What's your story?
Oh, I've always wanted to be a writer. When I was 3, I published my first novel using the Crayola stapler method.
Well done.
My mom helped. And to be fair, it wasn't a very good book. But
well, and yes, there's only so many words you can fit on the page with those, you know, the paper they had us write on when we were really little that had the two solid lines and the dotted line on the, I have a novel as well on that kind of paper. And it's, you know, you get like 12 words a page. It's really impressive.
I have one on cutout pieces of poster board, illustrated and with cloth. But I believe that I was more like 12. And I will say it's a highly derivative tale that does, however, still exist in my mother's home. We're all indie. We were all indie at the end.
That's right.
Yeah, all of us were indie.
Yeah, I wrote the, I'm dating myself, but when Walden Books came out with blank books, I was in middle school and I would buy a blank book and write a novel into it. And the novel would be just however many pages the blank book was. And I was a huge Stephen King fan. So like I would write these books. Like, I remember one was called Don't Go Into the Woods. And all these girls who looked a lot like girls who were kind of mean to me in middle school, one by one, went into the woods and no good came of it. You know, it was terrible, but really derivative Stephen King novel.
And then you get and you realize you only have 5 pages to go and you're like, God, I'm gonna wrap this up.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's probably not a bad structure.
That was what I was
story structuring.
That's what I was gonna ask. How do you plan that so that you know you can land on the right page? Because you know, you could just it's sort of like when you're, you know, making a poster and you think, oh, I've got plenty of room for all these bubble letters, and then you end up putting the last part of the last word in these tiny little letters. But you know, I can just envision a novel that all of a sudden in the last 5 pages gets microscopic in the handwriting because you realize you need more pages than you've got.
That is accurate. That's exactly what would happen every time. And like some storylines would just get wrapped up. And then her mother died. Like, I can't deal with that. I only have 2 pages. The terrible mother died and she was fine.
All right. So let's skip ahead to your adult life. How does writing sort of become a part of your adult life?
Do you mean it's my job?
Yeah, exactly. In terms of your professional work.
Oh,
because I know one little thing about you that I would love to interject here is the bit of trivia that you got plucked out of a slush pile.
I did, yeah.
How did that go down?
Yeah, I didn't know any better. You know, I didn't know any better. So what I did was I loaded up, I think 160 something query letters into a shotgun, pointed it at New York, which is, of course, insane. Don't do that. If you're getting ready to query a book, query 10, 15 agents. If you don't get like a 20% return of agents saying, let me see a partial or your manuscript, your query's not good enough. And it doesn't matter how good the book is. So to shoot off that many at once is just to burn all your lottery tickets when you don't know if your query is good enough and is representing your book to a point where somebody's going to take you seriously. Out of those 160 something queries, I got one request to look at the work, and that was my agent.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And that was the one that got pulled out of the slush pile.
Yeah, I mean, I just mean my letter got pulled out of his slush pile full of letters to, hey, I'm a nice person. I live here and I write novels. Would you like to represent them and sell them to a big press in New York City? You know, there's thousands of those they get every day. And it wasn't the best query, but he was interested in the idea. So he asked me to send the manuscript and I did, and we ended up working together.
And how did that first book deal go for you? How did that all come about?
Oh, it was a long time coming. So he was my agent, and he was interested in me. We had a couple of phone conversations. I sent him like some short stories I'd had published, and he shopped like 2 nonfiction book proposals, a children's book series, and 2 novels for me. And at that point, I was pretty ground down about it. Like, that's a lot of rejection and a lot of years and a lot of work. And so I just quietly said to myself, you know, I'm not going to break up with my agent. You know, I'm not going to have this big dramatic thing. I'm just going to stop sending him stuff. I'm going to stop calling him. I'm going to stop bothering him because I've done nothing but cost this guy money. So he's, you know, I'll just let it go and New York can suck it. I'm going to write because I can't imagine not writing, but I'm done trying to be published. It's, you know, I was like butt hurt. I picked up my toys. I went home. And that Christmas, he sent me a present and a letter. And it was like his family Christmas letter, just like, you know, we did fantastic things because we live in Connecticut. Amazing. You know, whatever your family, you know, the family Christmas letter. And at the bottom, he had written a little note just to me. And he said, when am I going to see something from you again? You really are one of my favorite writers. Which you don't say that to somebody who's never been published. You say, you're so talented. You say, you have so much potential. You say, I think we can sell this. You don't call an unpublished person one of your favorite writers. And it was just like, no one had ever.
Great.
Yeah. And so I sent him the manuscript I'd been working on, and he sent it out. He said, this is going to auction. And he sent it out to, I think, 8 places, like saying, this is an auction. You have 2 weeks. And we had a preempt in 2 days. And he made me turn the preempt down. He was like, I was like, not going to turn that preempt down. I was so excited. It was an offer of actual like folding money.
Yeah.
For a book I'd written.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, we're turning this down. And I was like, okay, technically I'm the boss of you and we're not turning it down. He's like, it's cute that you think that. But I'm the one who understands this industry and we're turning it down. But just say, yes, sir, we're turning it up. But we're turning it down. Then I threw up. We turned it down and he sent, you know, word out to the other houses that we had turned down a preempt and everybody had, I think, 48 hours to get their best offer in. And 5 of them showed up to bed. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah,
I seem to remember writing. I had to text in. I think I emailed with like shaking fingers in return when I heard that we had a preempt that was for an amount of money that I was like, wah! I remember typing back, okay, I trust you. But in my head, I was like, I totally don't trust you. We should accept this.
I don't trust you at all. Don't just take it quick before they figure out I'm faking it this whole time. Don't even know how to read.
I saw that you were part of a book called Don't Quit Your Day Job, Acclaimed Authors and the Day Jobs They Quit. So what was the day job you quit?
It's a job that I call Tote Monkey. I was a tote monkey. I'm dating myself again, but it was a car parts place that had these dot matrix printers. And when the stuff was all down on the floor from the printer, I would take a huge stack and peel those rinds off and then separate it like white, blue, pink, goldenrod, white, blue, pink, goldenrod, and then file each of those colors where they had to be filed. And by then the dot matrix printers would have another huge stacks lined up and I just take them and peel them. It was all I did.
Were you so sad to have to quit that job to become a professional writer?
I didn't quit that job to become a professional writer. I quit that job to go back. I had dropped out of college to be an actor and eventually was starving and had to take this day job. I called my father and I said, I want to go back to college. And he said, you can go back to college until you get a B. I'll pay for it until you get a B. So I went back to college and I never got a B. That job taught me that I didn't want to be like doing that job.
So the acting stuff leads us to the big questions that I'm dying to ask you about how you got started narrating your own audio work. And did that start from the beginning? Was that something that you specifically trained to do? Please tell us all about it because I have to sort of spoiler here is that some of the conversations we've had is about like, ooh, that's kind of interesting. I wonder what it would take to be able to narrate our own fiction. So what does it take, Jocelyn?
I don't think it's necessarily a good thing most of the time when authors read their own books, to be honest, because it is a really specific skill set. And I did go to school in theater and I've done most of the time, you know, I did live off the grid for a while as an actor and a playwright. And most of the time when I made money, it was doing voice acting. And I got some pretty good gigs. I've done voice acting for like, you know, local commercials and radio spots. But I've also done stuff for like a documentary that PBS was doing, stuff like that. So I had a theatrical background. And when my first novel came out, well, the narrator of that novel is a wildly promiscuous murderess. And people always think that your first novel is autobiographical, which of course my first novel was, but as you know from earlier, it did not sell. This was my third novel. So it wasn't autobiographical. I am not a wildly promiscuous murderess, for the record. And I wasn't sure how much I wanted to be associated with her any more than I was. You know, with a debut, that's the first question you get. So how much of this is your life? And so I didn't really want to do it. My second novel, I figured I had that distance. Plus, I also thought Arlene should sound really young. And I don't think I've ever sounded particularly young. She has to sound young for you to forgive her. But my second book, I really thought I could do it. So I went to my editor and I said, you know, I used to be an actor and I've done a lot of voice acting. Do you think I could read the audiobook? And she said, oh, no, no, God, no, no, don't do that. And I said, okay, but like I really have done it before. And she was like, you know, I was with Warner Books. They were the most theatrical of the audiobooks. Like some audiobook companies want a real straight read with just very light differentiations between the voices. And some of them want it to be really theatrical. This was a very theatrical one that wanted big differences in the voices, and they put musical tracks in and stuff. So I said, well, can I audition? And my editor said, yes, you can audition, but you're not going to get hired, but sure. So I had a friend named Darren Wong. He's actually an author too. He wrote The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, which is a great book. And he used to run an audiobook magazine called Verb. It was an all audio magazine. And so he had a home studio and a edit board. So we did it very, you know, it was a professional grade equipment, and he helped me edit it and set levels. And so it was a really good recording. And I turned in this, and I did like a fight scene with five different men having a fight. And I did a comedic scene so they would know my timing. And I did straight narration with energy so they knew I could get them through the landscape descriptions or whatever. And then after I turned that in, like 2 weeks later, my editor called and she was like, oh, yes, yes, you can read your audiobook. So I started reading my own, and the first one did well. And so after that, when the next time we got a book contract, they had a little clause in there that said, you know, I had to, if available, I had to read the audiobook. Like, it was already in the contract. But I thought that was really flattering. And now
that's really cool.
I read for other people who aren't me too.
I had heard that actually because our, as I said, our frequent guest, Serena Bowen, has a podcast called Story Bites with Tanya Evie. And Tanya has her own studio, and they're very, you know, they tend to be really pick apart narration, especially since Serena picks the narrators for her books. And, you know, she's very picky about that. And they raved about your narration. So that was.
Oh, that makes me feel good.
Yeah, they were one of the reasons we found out about you.
You were episode 3 of their Story Bites podcast. So if anyone would like to hear Jocelyn narrating the first chapter of The Almost Sisters, you can do that on episode 3 of Story Bites.
Yeah, that was
then cool. You'll want the rest. But no, if you yeah, need you to taste it for free, that's one way to do it.
Well, and that was also Serena raved about The Almost Sisters. That was a book that she really enjoyed, and we trust her judgment. So, It's been,
plus,
I have to say.
Plus, you know, we read it. I mean, I devoured it, and yeah. So come on. It's not like we're like, hey, come be on our podcast.
No, we haven't read any of your books.
But one of our friends did, and they really liked it.
No. What I meant was you guys have read The Almost Sisters. I have not yet. I'm going to now, though, because the first of Jocelyn's books that I have read is Never Have I Ever, and I am so deep in. And what I wanted to say is I'm listening to the audio, and I also have the hardcover of the book as well. And one of the things I wanted to say about your narration there is you have two different, very different women in particular that are sort of at the heart of this book. And I have to say that what I was struck by from the very beginning is your depiction of Rue, one of the two main sort of mainish characters. And you do such a brilliant job with her, because I'm not even sure what it is you're doing because I don't have the technical words to describe it, but there's something in her voice that renders her a completely different human being than your protagonist, who has such a, I don't know. Do you, I've heard for various audiobook narrators that they'll often have like recordings of their characters, or are you able to do that just sort of as you go through?
I don't use recordings. I do use my husband. I met him doing Black Box Theater. We were working at a regional repertory theater together. The first time I ever saw him, he was learning to like stage sword fight. That is hot.
that is hot.
And so we've known each other since we were teenagers. I was 18. I think he was 19. And he is a theater guy. He was a master's degree is in stage management. So when I'm getting ready to do an audiobook, I go through and set voices with him. And he says, no, that's not right. Or, oh, that sounds just like her, but can you take it just a little deeper, drop your register just a little bit. So he works with me on the characters because it's good to have that, you know, my voice sounds different in my head. So he's sort of my feedback loop. And then I'm an outside in actor. Like I was never method where you go inside and try to find some memory and attach it. I've always been like, if you put your body and face into the shape, you'll feel the thing that you're, you know, that your body is in the shape of. So the way I set characters is with a stance and a facial expression. So if I get into a certain position and hold my face a certain way, that voice just comes out because that's what I have the character attached to. So I'm sure it looks bizarre to my sound editor and director when I'm in there doing a scene with a bunch of different people talking as I fold myself into different shapes and make these weird facial expressions, but it works.
That's really interesting. That reminds me of, I was lucky enough to see Bradley Cooper play the Elephant Man.
Yeah.
And at the very, very beginning, he walks out to the middle of the stage, to center stage as, you know, just a guy, as Bradley Cooper. But he becomes the character by changing his body shape. That's how he does it. And he does it right in front of you so that you can see it happen. And it's a really cool thing. I think you should totally set up some video so that we can see what it looks like.
I feel like I would rather not see it myself because I don't want to feel self-conscious about it because it works. And I just, maybe I don't want to see that.
Well, so the next question I have then is, now that you do all, I mean, you do all this narration, do you hear your characters as you write them?
Yes, but I always have. And I mean, like the kind of stuff I'm talking about with setting voices, that takes a lot longer for a book I didn't write. For a book I did write, I know what these people sound like in my head, and I just try to approximate that with the voice and the range that I have, which, you know, is getting harder as I get older. I'm in another 10 years, I probably won't have the vocal elasticity to do my side gig anymore. So I'm kind of trying to do a few more because I love it. I'm doing a few more a year than I used to, just to be able to do it while I can, because you really do need some good elasticity. And I'm not willing to like give up drinking or, you know, fried food entirely and coddle my vocal cords to try and get another 5 years out of them. But yeah.
Can you tell ahead of time when a line is not going to work? KJ and I talked about this because we were lucky enough to be able to record our nonfiction books, and other friends of ours have done the same, where you hit a line. And I used to be a speechwriter as well. And I remember specifically, I wrote a speech for a governor and we got to rehearsal with the prompter and there was just a line. He's like, this is never going to come out right. It's just not, it's not coming out of my mouth right. Do you ever hear that when you're writing, or do you just not worry about that?
I definitely hear it when I'm writing because I read aloud to myself.
Nice.
As a writer, like especially dialogue, I'll read it out loud while I'm writing. I mutter and talk while I'm writing. And if a paragraph doesn't sound right or I'm having trouble with it, I'll read it aloud. And sometimes I edit aloud, like I'll just change it in mid-sentence to make it sound better and then just write down what I heard myself say.
Huh. Over my 20 years as an English teacher, I have told my students over and over and over again, if you want really good editing, if you would like to really get your paper clean, you've got to read it out loud.
Yeah, it is so smart. And just speaking as an audiobook reader, as a person who reads them aloud, and I listen to them obsessively. And you can tell the people who don't read their work aloud from the people who do, not because it's, you know, it's that huge of a difference where now the book's not good or anything like that, but like people who read them aloud have so much less unintentional internal rhyme. Like when you're just looking at words, you can write a sentence like, Mike took the bike down the street with his friend Reich and they ate a pike, you know, and you don't hear it because it's visual and you don't see it. But then when you're listening to an audiobook, I'll hear like a string of rhymes and I'll be like, that person did not read their book out loud.
Well, and there actually, when we interviewed Stephen Strogatz about his book, he has a book that just came out recently about calculus that's just, it's just beautiful. He said that he dictates when he writes, and he found his last line of his book because of the rhythm, because he was walking at the time. And so that rhythm then made it into his writing because it was spoken in the first place and not because it was just his fingers dancing across the keyboard. So I find it fascinating. And Serena Bowen also uses dictation software as well. And our guest from Karen Culp that we interviewed just recently, she also uses dictation software. So I'm always curious about the difference between dictation and just writing with your hands and being able to hear those things and how that changes your work. So that is fascinating to me. It had never occurred to me that maybe I would be writing in rhymes unintentionally.
Yeah, I've never tried to use dictation software, but maybe I should, because I do so much in an auditory. I mean, I listen so much. It's weird. Like, I tried to be a playwright for a while, and I'm not a very good playwright, to be honest, because I'm not willing to leave that room. Like, a play should be a framework where a director can come in and do things, and then there's room for actors to come in and do things so that it's a different play every time. And I'm just like obsessively, I'm not saying I have control issues, but I have control issues. And like writing a play, like I've just always felt like I was trying to lock stuff down and make it be the way it is in my head. And it felt like it was coming from like the whole front of my head would heat up. Whereas when I'm acting or when I'm writing a novel and I am in control of, you know, what I do, even though of course you're being reactive, I feel like it's coming from the occipital lobe. Like it feels like it mm-hmm. comes from a different place in my brain.
That's so interesting. There was an interview a long time ago I heard with Michael Ondaatje, and he said he does not hear his work at all. He only sees it. And it's very difficult for me. I don't hear my work either. I do nonfiction though, so maybe it's different, but for me, it's very visual and not sound related. So it's always fascinating to get into the head of someone who writes differently. Like, I just don't hear it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I don't, if I'm engaging it just in the terms of the visual, it's not going to get where I need it to be.
One of the things you did for this most recent book is you learned, so a central thing in this book is scuba diving.
Yeah.
And this was something you had never done before, right?
No, never.
So how did you even, not having had the experience, I just assumed when I listened to the book that, oh, that's something she does. And isn't that cool? She's fluid with, you know, she knows what the words are. But how did you even know that was going to be a thing if you had never done it before?
Amy was always a scuba diver. I wanted the metaphor. Like, the ocean was so perfect for what I was doing in terms of, like, being – if you've ever dropped your sunglasses off a boat, you know, the ocean can hide anything. So in terms of, like, you're never getting those back. In terms of being, like, this massive place where you can put things that you – that are just gone forever, and also being kind of an entity with its own breath, so that your secrets are sort of housed in this living system. There were lots of metaphors that I wanted that scuba diving gave me. And so I watched YouTube videos and did some interviews, and I was like, I'm not getting this. I went to my husband and I said, hey, baby, it's about time for my midlife crisis. And I need to learn to scuba dive for this book. I think my midlife crisis is going to be scuba diving. Would you like to have it with me? He had already had his midlife crisis. He learned to play the bass and joined a band. But he was like, yeah, I'll do yours with you. That sounds really fun. If the other choice is an oiled cabana boy, I say scuba diving. Let's go. so we started diving, and it really changed the book. Like, I knew that Amy, you know, Amy has this, Amy's my narrator, the protagonist, the scuba diving instructor. She's the one who has sort of the dark past and she's entirely reinvented herself. You know, I wanted that baptismal imagery. You go into the water, you come up a different person. And she, I had another way, you know, she's very self-destructive after she does this kind of terrible thing. She almost doesn't survive it. She has so much guilt. And then she sort of navigates her own understanding of grace, and she reinvents herself and finds a life she can sustain. But I needed something to be the pivot that she uses to save herself. And I tried a bunch of different things, and scuba diving was also in there. And then after I was diving, I was like, I don't need anything else. This is what saves her, because it's so, it's like yoga plus plus. It is meditation. It is prayer. You cannot project into the future. You cannot worry about the past. It grounds you entirely in the present. You actually use your own breath. Like, once you have a good technical ability to dive, once you've practiced enough and you're not fussing with your equipment all the time and you really understand how to get neutrally buoyant in the water, you actually change levels in the water and aim yourself just using your own breath. So it's your breath inside the ocean's breath. It is, it's also like super fun. There's octopuses, yeah. You know, so.
So it's, I love the idea of someone finding freedom in an activity that many people would find completely claustrophobic and closed in. So there was something really interesting about scuba diving as a metaphor, as I also scuba dive, something that a lot of people wouldn't be able to bear because it would feel too close. For her, it's exactly that that gives her the freedom. I don't know. I loved that metaphor.
You dive?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so cool. Yeah. You know, we're one percenters. We're not that rich.
I haven't done it for a very long time, but I spent a lot of time. I thought I wanted to be a marine biologist. So I spent one summer diving nearly every day, actually, when I was young. And it's transformative. Yeah. It's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
I, on the other hand, would probably jump out of a plane first.
I would never jump out of a plane.
You know, I have no intention of ever jumping out of a plane, but I was just trying to come up with my other least likely. Yeah, so I belong to the large percentage of people who would not find freedom in scoop, mostly because I would not survive.
No, you'd be fine. I'm claustrophobic. I will take the stairs over an elevator unless it's like 25 stories. I am super claustrophobic. I can't stand in closed spaces, especially like crowds and stuff. But it's like, I mean, I would never cave dive. Like, that's insane. I would never do that. But like, I don't understand the claustrophobia thing. Like, it's so wide open. It's the whole freaking ocean.
Oh, I'm not. No, I'm afraid of water.
Yeah.
I feel like
that's pretty. I'm not at all claustrophobic.
In fact,
you're right.
I could nap in an MRI chamber. But
people say, "Oh, I can't do that. I'm claustrophobic." I don't get. That's what I don't get. If you're afraid of water, yeah, don't do it. My son.
I don't think it's for me.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I mean, my
son is actually afraid of the bigness that I described to him. I got to hang out in the Gulf of Mexico once, you know, and once you go over that wall, once the wall is behind you and you're in this essentially what looks like endless blue. And that, he says, is the most frightening thing for him. Like, he has nightmares about that because anything could be underneath him and it's just endless. So that in a way makes him feel it's too much. I suppose that's what I meant by claustrophobia, I guess.
That's so interesting. Well, our daughter was like, I want to do it too. So now she's a diver, and our son is like, that will never happen, but thank you for the offer.
Well, and I have to, one of the things I wanted to say about this book, so KJ and I talk all the time about people's ability to A, stick the landing on books, and B, surprise us.
Trust me, she sticks the landing and she surprises us.
Well, the surprise thing I can attest to, because I was listening to it as I was before I went to sleep last night, and I had headphones on and my husband was reading something else, and I got really upset and I said, oh, well, duh, I figured that out a while ago. And then you totally tricked me. You completely messed with my head. I thought I was ahead of you and you were so ahead of me. And I love that. I mean, the ability to be surprised is huge, especially since is huge for me because there are so many books, KJ can attest to this, that I have thrown. I've joked about throwing books across the room because I get so angry at formulas that make me feel dumb as a reader. And you made me feel like you had me. You really had me.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I enjoy a plot really twist.
How much of that do you set up ahead of time, and how much of it, and how has that evolved over the course of 9 books?
So this was my first book that is really leaning hard into, you know, domestic noir and being.
Yeah,
more...
this is. I would agree that this is twistier, but I can actually only go back to the Almost Sisters, but that one's pretty twisty too.
Yeah, I always use the engine of a murder mystery or a thriller. I always have. Sometimes to greater degrees than others, plot twists, because I enjoy it. But it's really the only thing that's changed in terms of genre is like the stakes and the pacing. This is just the stakes are super high. There's more crime instead of them being more human. I don't know how to explain it. It really is just about stakes raising. It's still my voice, my kinds of fierce female characters who act instead of reacting, my thematic things I'm always interested in. You know, I'm always writing about redemption and motherhood. So yeah, I would agree with you. But for me, the plot is the thing that comes last. Plot's the cookie. I understand what I want to address thematically very, very well. I understand these characters down to their bones. Sometimes I think about characters for years before I write them. I've been thinking about Rue and for a vehicle to write Rue for more than 7 years. And mm-hmm. She was a hard person to place because she's difficult. But
she's slippery.
Yeah,
you wouldn't want her placed in your life.
No, you wouldn't want her placed in your life. She's a nightmare, but she's a very interesting nightmare. So I know the characters, I know the stakes, I know the themes, and the plot is the cookie. Like, I'm glad. I mean, I try to play fair too. Like, something will happen and it'll really surprise me, and then I go back and edit and put in clues and foreshadowing because. Like I'm good at it. I have a facility for this. You know, I think as writers, we all have things that we're good at and things that we really struggle with. I'm good at crafting those kind of plot twists. That's the thing that comes easily to me because it's fun and I'm surprising myself too. And I try to play fair so that at least some readers will catch on to what I'm doing. Or if you go back and read it a second time, you're like, oh, right there. She practically tells me right there. But you slide it into these little moments where you're describing a car and nobody's paying attention. Or, you know, there's all kinds of tricks you can do to misdirect. It's like a magician sleight of hand with coins. They do everything. They got you looking at the wrong place when they do the thing.
I'm at the stage of a revision where I have a list of about 6 things that I just need to go back and make sure are properly
set up.
Yeah. And it, you know, it doesn't take that much, and it's, you know, but
and
it has
you have to play
definitely
fair.
Yeah.
I don't like the twist.
And also it's just not right because I did read something recently where a character very suddenly took a turn that I really, I mean, it's not like I went back, but I was like, what? There was like one warning of this and none of the warning came from the character. So it yanked me.
Like, yeah.
So you have to find that line where you've given people enough preparation that they aren't pulled out of the story by, wait a minute, is this consistent with what happened before?
Flannery O'Connor says you have to get to an end that feels inevitable yet surprising.
Yeah.
And that's what I love her. We genuflect when we say Flannery. But yeah, so
it's so funny you guys are saying that about fiction because that's what I'm working on right now, even in nonfiction, where I have 2 chapters and they're sort of two chapters that really go together, and one was submitted with my proposal. So I wrote that a long time ago, and then the other one I just finished. So I have them now side by side because I need to plant seeds for one in the other in order for the reader to be led a bit down a path and for things to at least feel like I've prepared them a little bit for what's coming next. And I love that part of the process. I love it. It feels like, you know, it's you know, with nonfiction, it's not really about hints, but it is. It is anyway. It's narrative hinting, even though it's nonfiction. I love that.
Yeah, I think that's really actually cool that translates into nonfiction. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's all about creating something satisfying. I think either way, you know, if there aren't a bunch of through lines, then you just got a bunch of different stories.
Well, and it's funny that you say something about, you were talking about hearing, and I said I don't hear my work, but that's actually not true, because I always try to end on a major chord. You know, there's that sort of resolution to, like, you know, a major chord at the end where your reader can go, okay, yeah, that feels good. And so I do hear that little bit. I try to come back to a major chord at the end of a chapter so that I leave my reader feeling at least not like they're, you know, hanging there on a dissonant note and that I've just dumped them off the edge. So, well, there is a little bit of sound there.
Let's hope we've left our listeners on a major chord at this point, because it's time to shift gears and talk about what we've been reading.
Okay.
Please share with us what
you have been
reading, Jocelyn.
Guest first.
So I always have a book and an audiobook going. And do y'all, can I do a little commercial for Libro FM if anybody doesn't know?
Oh, please do. We love Libro FM.
I absolutely can.
So the way I get my audiobooks is through a service called Libro FM, which it's just like any other subscription service. You know, you get a credit every month and your credits never expire, and it costs about this. It is costs exactly the same, but it benefits your local independent bookseller. You choose the store you want to shop through. So, of course, I'm all over that. So I was listening to Gretchen by, I think her last name is Kirk. Shannon Kirk is my listen. Mm-hmm. This is some next level WTF. Like, I loved this book. It is so smart. Like, I don't even know if it's a thriller or it verges on horror, but, and then I loved the character so much. And the character of Gretchen, I dream about. It's really good. It's about a young woman who's on the run with her mother, and they have hidden identities, and they move into this little shack. They have to leave, and they're on the run again. And the girl next door is named Gretchen, and she finds herself involved in, like, this, puzzles are a big metaphor, this game with Gretchen that has these very far-reaching consequences.
Okay, I'm on their website right now getting this book. I'm so excited.
And then the book just finished reading with my eyes is called The Better Liar. I can't remember the author's name. It's Tannen something. I remember the first name because
it'll be in the show notes.
Unusual. Oh, good. But it's called The Better Liar. It doesn't come out till January. Here's what I liked about it. It's
Tannen Jones, by the way.
Tannen Jones. It's a thriller. It's suspense, which I really, really like. But And it's fun. Like, the plot is fun and twisty and sinister, but she's doing something so smart and so emotionally resonant just under the surface that, you know, I went to it for, like, a fun, twisty read, and it is. Like, I got that, but at the end, I was not just like, whoa, at the twists. I was like, whoa, holy crap. Like, there was an emotional surprise. It's about a woman who has to appear with her estranged sister to claim her inheritance, and she has reasons for needing the money. And when she goes to find her sister, who's a troubled person, she finds her body, but she meets somebody else who looks like her sister, and they go, who has secrets of her own, and they go to try and claim this inheritance. It is great.
Oh, that is real. That's a great premise. I'm going to have to buy that one too.
Yeah. And then
I'm going to have to get that one.
Just finished both of those. And I just started Lady in the Lake by Laura Lippman. And it's great so far, which is completely unsurprising because I've never read a Laura Lippman book and gone, oh, well, that was disappointing. Like, I'm always, she's so good. I'm loving it so far.
Okay, KJ, you're up. What have you been reading?
I have not been reading anything new, to be honest. Okay. I'm in the middle of something that I like, but I'll wait till we finish it. I'm in the middle of Range by David Epstein, which we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. I'm rereading. I'm doing a lot of rereading right now. I have a list of like fresh books I read this year, and I was thinking I should make a list of books I actually reread too.
Oh, well, and
for my own personal use.
I have been joking around on our text, our little text trio, that I have been, because my brain is so occupied right now with getting to my deadline and finishing this book, that I've been doing a lot of re-listening, and my re-listening choices have been Serena Bowen books. And so every once in a while, I'll text Serena with, you know, some observation about some character she wrote like 8 years ago. And it's just really comforting. But
it
I have
occurs
reading,
to me, but wait, I actually forget. It occurs to me that I did forget to mention that I might have just read a book called Never Have I Ever by Jocelyn Jackson.
I was just about to say that
so
exact thing.
So I did,
because
in
I'm
fact,
not done
just
yet.
Read an entire and finish an entire novel, which normally would have been what I put on a hymn reading. So, and it is great, and it is twisty, and it is turny, and it is satisfying, and it's really satisfying. So, you know,
I really, really love it. And recommend. While I have you, I do have to ask you one quick question, Jocelyn, which is, did the title come first or did the premise come first?
The premise came first. In fact, I had almost finished the book with a completely different title that I don't remember. It wasn't a great title. And my friend Sarah Gruen was like, why aren't you calling this Never Have I Ever? Dummy. I was like, oh, I don't know. You're so right. That's obviously the title. Never mind.
I love that, because I was, ever since I started, when I started the book, that was kind of one of my first questions. I wrote it on the inside flap, which came first, the cover or the title or the premise, because it's great. Both of them are great. I also have been listening to Emily Nussbaum, who's the television critic at The New Yorker. She has a book called I Like to Watch, and it's all about being a television critic, which is something I don't know. I don't think I would do, but I'm fascinated by the job. I'm fascinated that the job exists, and I'm a huge fan of Emily Nussbaum to begin with. So I'm loving this, and this is a book that you can read in chunks because it's sort of like essay format, and it's really lovely, which is not surprising because Emily Nussbaum is a lovely writer. So I recommend that. So far, I'm not done with it either.
Awesome.
All right. Independent bookseller.
Oh, I live in Decatur, Georgia, and we have like so many indies. So I'll just mention, and I they're my favorite things to visit when I travel. I live like 4 blocks from Eagle Eye, so that's my walk up and get a book independent. And then down on the square, there's a store called Little Shop of Stories, which is a kids shop. It's like an independent that just sells children books and a lot of YA. But they have a super curated adult section. And sometimes I get overwhelmed at the bookstore, and I like to just go to a little shop where you only have this many books to choose from. And they're all hand-picked by hand sellers who read obsessively all the time. Like, you're not going to get a bad book there. So I can just go in there and just, like, it's kind of relaxing to have less choices.
That visiting bookstores all over the country is like our sport. That's one of our favorite things.
It's
absolutely. And then I have to help KJ winnow down what she's purchased because they won't all fit in her suitcase, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that might have happened.
She's even worse when she goes to England. She goes to England and then brings back like a box of books with her. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's so fun when you're somewhere else and you can find books that don't actually, there are actually books that have not been published here.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or I had a
covers.
Lovely time with my Canadian cover of Educated. And then I was sitting by someone at the pool this summer, and I looked over and I was like, I'll bet they're from Canada because they're reading Educated with the good cover, not the cover that I didn't like, which the American publisher put on it.
What does the Canadian cover look like? Not the pencil?
No, the Canadian cover is a, I thought it, well, by comparison, I thought it was less evocative than the children's school desk set in a middle of a field in front of the mountain that she actually lived near.
Oh, that's,
you actually
that
get
does sound
to
good.
See the mountain.
Yeah,
I mean, getting
and,
to see
and it's
that
just,
mountain.
I don't that's know. Cool. To me, it worked a lot better than the pencil, which could, you know, while there wasn't anything wrong with it, could go with a lot of books, like say Jess's book,
like my book.
The pencil has a scene in it. Like the pencil has the mountain inside of it.
I guess I never noticed that, which suggests it didn't really work.
For me, it worked, but I guess you're right. I noticed that I'd already bought the book because my mom told me it was great before. I know you're right. Maybe it needed to be, but there is the pencil has the wilderness in
it. Is the wilderness kind of like the pencil line across? Okay, so that makes some sense, but I'm afraid it was lost on me.
Yeah, it's the Canadian ones.
Good effort,
really cool.
Though.
I'm going to go look at it.
Yeah, it's likable.
All right. Well, man, we have gone long, but I have to admit I could talk about this stuff forever. You've been such a great guest and so generous with your time, and thank you, and keep narrating. And I see this is another fun moment where now I have a new author. I'm loved this book, and now I get to go back and listen to your other books. I get to have, you know, I have those queued up now, so I've got some listening to do. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. This is really fun.
If people would like to find out more about you, where should they go?
JocelynJackson.com, spelled my weird way. I'm also on Instagram and the Twitter.
We'll link to all of those places in the show notes for this episode of the podcast. And again, thank you so much. And for everyone who is listening, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag MWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work.
Thank you.